From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is underway, a half hour of commentary, analysis, and maybe even some insight into the news media issues of the week, and we are glad to have you joining us. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, your host today. Dr. Alan Chartok is not with us. He's off actually vacationing, believe it or not. We've got a great crew here in the studio. Here next to me, of course, is Ira Fussfeld, longtime publisher of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York.
Nice to be back.
Yes, wonderful to see you, sir, back from your ventures here, there, and everywhere. Down at the end of the table, in the Chartok seat, is Paul Conte, a longtime news director for the NBC affiliate, News Channel 13 in the Capital Region, now professor at the College of St. Rose. Sir, how are you?
Good. How are you, Rex?
I am okay. It's great to see you. My goodness. So you'll bring some wisdom from academia. It's always good to have a professor here.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
And he's sitting in that seat, so he has passed to interrupt as much as he wants.
Yeah. And first time on the Media Project, Jen Smith, reporter and engagement editor at the Berkshire Eagle in Massachusetts. How are you?
I'm very well. Good to have a seat at this table.
Yeah, cool. You often, those of you who listen to the roundtable in the morning at WAMC, those of you who are not off in Waxahachie or Evansville or wherever you're hearing this show, probably recognize Jen's voice, but she hasn't been in this studio before, so it's great to have you.
Thank you.
So actually, we need to start with the latest departure from the Trump administration, I think. You know, here we are sitting in upstate New York in this studio, but we're talking about what's going on at the White House as though we know, but there is something that we do have experience with, and that is this. Hope Hicks, the longtime aide, let's say, to Donald Trump, to the extent that there is such a thing, has become the fourth communication director of the White House to depart during the 14 months of the Trump administration. She is leaving and actually announced her resignation one day after telling a congressional committee that she sometimes told white lies on behalf of the president. And I'm just wondering, for the little assessment of the group here, about the value of flackery in politics, about the value of folks who are the official spokespeople or message shapers for our leaders when there's a concession that, in fact, they're not telling the truth. What do you think?
Well, do we start with the premise that she was the only flackery person who has told white lies? I mean, I think those of us who are in the newspaper business for more than 10 minutes sort of expect that from the people who are bringing in press releases or plugging stories. Doesn't excuse it, but I don't think it's abnormal. The thing that strikes me about Hope Hicks is she appeared to be entirely unqualified for that position, but she was a close aide of Ivanka and became friendly with the president. So there she was at number one. And number two, the title communications director suggests that there is a communications policy that she or someone set. And other than calling news fake news, I'm not quite certain I can point to a communications policy there. So for the outside world, I'm not sure it's going to make much difference who is in that chair.
And I think for the outside world, a lot of people are hearing these headlines this morning and saying, Hope Hicks who? Because it's so hard to keep track of who's, you know, bringing information out of this administration's office, who knows what, you know, talking about headlines, looking at, we don't even know who has security clearance levels in this administration. So it's just another part of this line of exits, first of all, this week under the administration, but also adds to the confusion, and there's no clarity on what messages are coming out of this office because of issues like this.
And it's topsy-turvy from one day to the next. Mm-hmm. The president often contradicts himself, and his aides are really left scrambling to know what is the administration line.
My worry is that, well, first of all, she did it under oath, right? She admitted telling a lie under oath.
But not to the FBI, to the House.
To the House. Yeah. It's still under oath.
Yeah.
So there's that. But I think sometimes when people read, listen, or watch news conferences, they wonder why reporters continue to ask the same question repeatedly. And they're accused of bias because they're trying to get to an answer. You said, and you are right, that we can assume that certain flacks tell lies. That's why journalists ask the same question repeatedly to get to the truth, something that's not always easy to do. And now you have somebody on the record saying, yeah, I told lies.
You know, the interesting thing, actually, I think Ira's point was that all flacks lie.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is an old line. I used to cover the courts for a newspaper downstate. And the guy who I replaced when I took over the beat said, here's something you need to know about testimony. This is going to be controversial. Here's what you need to know if you're going to cover the courts. Number one, all cops lie. Number two, all prosecutors know that all cops lie. Number three, all judges tolerate the facts that prosecutors put on cops who lie. So he said there's fundamentally lying going on in the courtroom all the time to convict people who are fundamentally guilty. So, you know, that was a stunning thing for a young reporter who at that time I thought it was important for me to get to know how things are done. But I think it's even more pervasive in politics. I spent 4 years as a political press secretary myself for an obscure member of Congress from the Midwest years and years ago. And I remember thinking when I took off to go to Washington, I'm going to be the eyes and ears of the people of the 2nd District of Indiana on Capitol Hill. In fact, my job was to help the boss get reelected. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important for us to recognize, and to your point, Paul, that reporters understand that the job of flackery is to enhance the principle. And that is why they have to dig so hard to try to get at the truth.
Or at least to get at information.
Get at information. Thank you.
Well, and I think the issue with this now is it's not only reporters being savvy to it, it's the public, right? We're at a level where there's this demand for accountability, transparency, but there's also this counter effect of apathy when we just expect, where it's not surprising that Hope Hicks lied or spread white lies. It's just, oh, this is politics is normal and doesn't matter what we do, what we think, what we read, whether it's fake news or white lies from a press office. It adds fuel to this, you know, storm against trust of what we're reading.
The general cynicism factor is enhanced by this, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But one of the great mysteries of this administration, and I don't know how many historians it's going to take to try to sort this out, is that for all the reasons that Jen and Paul alluded about the public's distrust and transparency, etc., the president lies unlike anybody else that I think any of us can remember, particularly in that office. Not only that, his lies are easily disproven. I mean, you know, he'll say X and you can look in a book and yesterday he said Y. You know, it's the old, there used to be a boxing promoter, still a boxing promoter named Bob Arum. And he had a famous line that was, I was lying yesterday, but I'm telling the truth today.
Right.
And this is much broader than the media project, but why is it that even with the demand for transparency and change in government that swept Trump into office, his supporters, admittedly a hopefully dwindling number, still stand by him despite him doing all of the things and worse that they felt were horrible in past administrations?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's a diminishing number, though. You know?
Well, I mean, the most recent poll was somewhere between 35 and 37% approval rating. He had gone up to about 40 after the tax bills, and then it slid back down again.
Mm-hmm. Will it make any difference, is your question, I guess, if people think that the White House is managed by people who don't have a respect for the truth? I don't know that people are so accustomed to it. And if that is the case, if we don't have an expectation that our public officials, if the leaders of our government are actually truth tellers, what are the implications of that for democracy? Do we really have any confidence that the choices we're making are based upon intelligent information?
I think this administration has done so much to damage the press and other institutions in our society that we have held dear, and I don't know how long it's going to take, if at all, to reverse it. And by the way, if Hope Hicks admittedly told white lies, what color do you think the lies are that Sarah Sanders tells almost every day from that podium?
And I think that's it too. For us in the press corps, our next question is who's next or what's next? Will Sarah Sanders take that post? And then who goes into her position? It was the same thing after Spicer left. And, it, you know, it's this revolving door of people who we don't trust. We're not getting straight answers from. And again, it just diminishes, you know, I don't know if it even diminishes the quality of work that we do. It just pushes us to not even go to the White House as a source anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I view lies as binary.
Sorry?
I view lies as binary.
Lies are binary.
Yeah, they either are or they aren't.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They're on or off. There's no in between. Putting the word white in front of lie doesn't make it a lesser lie. Mm-hmm. It's still a lie. And by the way, not for nothing. Why is it a white lie?
If you were still active in the news director or producing business in Washington, D.C., would you send a reporter to the press briefings? Are they wasting their time going to those things?
Yes, probably they are, but I would still send someone on the remote chance that news gets made there, even if it's under the guise of lying, because obvious lying is still news.
Yeah.
The difficult role for a press secretary in a situation like this is being the liaison, especially in the White House. I've read some about this. I mean, obviously, it's at a very different level from the press secretary role that I filled many years ago. But these people have to have enough credibility with the reporters so that the reporters come to them for information. If the press secretary is absolutely incredible, that is not credible, there is no reason for anybody to even turn to you for information. And then alternate routes are built. Same way that your brain circuitry wires after you go at a certain level for a while. Alternate routes are built for source building, and the official source is of no value. But when the White House, when the president demands that the press secretary behave in a certain way that is contrary to fact, that really builds distrust, and ultimately it does not serve the administration well. Truth-telling ultimately is of value. The other thing that's of value is interesting to note that the most valuable press secretaries, the most valuable spokespeople for any politician are those who really know what's going on. There are great examples, actually, in the Carter administration. Jody Powell, the White House press secretary, was very close to the president. He was in on every decision that was made. And he may not have known much about how the media operated, but he did know what Jimmy Carter thought. And that kind of thing is an important element to really be a well-informed person. That's why reporters often go not to a press secretary, but to a chief of staff or somebody else who they know is right there.
Why do you suppose, and maybe you don't agree with the premise, when Sean Spicer, in his brief tenure as press secretary, after a while he was vilified, pretty much widely so, for his attitude and for his, my words, white lies, if not greater than white lies. Sarah Sanders, who is just as horrific under that definition, and maybe even more so, has largely gone without criticism. Do you agree with that? Or
I don't agree that she's gone without criticism. I think she hasn't become a regular character on Saturday Night Live.
Well, yeah, although she has been. Well, you know, yes. No less a political savant than Jimmy Kimmel, the late night host, wondered aloud about this and said, he believes, and I'm paraphrasing, that because she's a female, because she's overweight, and because she has that Southern accent, that people are afraid to mock her for, and rightly so, she shouldn't be mocked for any of those three things. On the other hand, he said, well, look at her every day. She's sort of that snarling, condescending look about her, barely answering the questions, and the reporters are like sheep, sort of just taking it. Would it be inappropriate for one of those reporters in the press room to pull a Dan Rather when he famously said to Nixon, you know, what are you running for, to say, Sarah, stop being condescending to me and answer the question?
Yeah.
Wouldn't you love to see a reporter do that in
but
a White
in
House
essence,
press
room? Hasn't that sort of happened?
I don't see this sort of persistence.
Didn't somebody from NPR get into it?
Maybe.
I think people have just become inured to it. Don't you think that now it's not a novelty anymore the way it was when Sean Spicer first stood at the podium and insisted that the inaugural crowds were really huge.
I'm sorry, it just makes me laugh still.
Alternate facts, you know, alternate
Bigly,
facts.
Bigly, Bigly laughs.
Bigly. So this is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. If you want to be a part of the conversation, you can send us email at media@wamc.org. and we will take your thoughts into account. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Jen Smith of the Berkshire Eagle and Ira Fussfeld and Paul Conte, and we are the media project for today. You know, we want to talk about when photographs lie. This is kind of a cool thing. Tom Palmer is a journalism professor at the University of Albany. He is also the design director of the Times Union. He does a blog called Picture Prosecutor, where he takes a look at photos that are not what they are said to be, how they are misused. And he's got a particularly interesting element here, a New York Times photo showing Barack Obama signing some bill from 2012. And it is being used on a fake news website under the headline, Obama signs executive order banning Pledge of Allegiance in schools nationwide. Well, of course, the president didn't do any such thing. There was no such bill. But when you put a photograph with a story, when you do a visual that seems to support the narrative of a story, it enhances the credibility, right? And I don't know how we can combat that in our line of work.
Well, I think it's understanding that that's a perception of credibility, but I think it's a real problem to address. There are studies out there that show, especially the current college age generation, if it looks sharp and professional, whether that's an infographic or a photograph, it seems more credible. It seems more believable. But to counter that, in basic media literacy courses, if they're offered, if you have the advantage of them being offered, you could put that photo through a filter like TinEye, which is a source that verifies that and say, oh, here's the origin. It doesn't go with the story. But again, is that being taught? Is that being taught to the public? Is that being taught to journalism students to be wary of this trend?
Couldn't that kind of software be applied by Google, by Facebook, by platforms? Isn't that maybe part of what's being discussed or should be being discussed in the context of saying these platforms are not just delivery vehicles, they are influencing society significantly, and there ought to be some regulation? Or is that too dangerous a slope in the nation of the First Amendment?
I think consumers just have to be more aware. I made a blanket statement this week on Facebook that any picture which people are sharing, I assume, is false. That's my starting point. And then we go forward and see what we can find out. Some of them are innocuous. There's one floating around about peppers. I don't know if you've seen it. Peppers that have two bumps on the bottom are one gender of pepper, and the one that has four bumps on the bottom is another gender of pepper. And it turns out that's not true at all. It's just the way it grew. It has nothing to do with anything at all. But how many times have you seen free trips to Disney World or free tickets on Southwest or whatever because there's a picture attached to it? I just assume they're all false.
It's the era of clickbait and memes and GIFs. And, you know, we even have that problem on our own websites. You go to the Berkshire Eagle, for example, you see our articles tend to be at the top of our website. And towards the bottom, you see this sponsored content, which is as media outlets struggle to raise revenues. You know, this is one way where we're earning income. And even though it says sponsored content, it may be, you know, an eighth of a point of a font to indicate. So, and it's hard, especially because we're digesting so much information all at once in, you know, a matter of minutes, that we're not taking the time to look, to question. Again, unless that's a conscious effort, you're being taught to critically think about what you're looking at. There is with a visual like this post that we're talking about, it's hard in a quick glance to discern the difference.
But it's not new. I mean, we can be outraged, and we should be outraged if a web platform or any other platform takes a picture knowingly and uses it in a different context, knowingly to fool the readers. But you know, those of us in print have been through and may still be going through issues of what is advertorial and what is not advertorial, meaning advertising content that looks like news content, and the readers may not be able to distinguish between what is news and what is advertising. You know, we can say, we meaning the newspapers, what we label it, you know, it's paid advertisement or whatever word we choose to use, but readers are often not able to see it because we run it too small or because they just don't pay attention. And this just adds to another level of this issue of news literacy that we've mm-hmm. talked about here for a long time. People should read these things and look at TV and be discerning about them. But this is a country with 300 million people, and the odds that at least six of them are not going to do it are pretty good.
Yeah. To Jen's point, I mean, I do think that there is a serious issue that publishers, broadly speaking, not just you, Ira, and your cohort, but the broad notion of publishers need to take a look at, and that is these programmatic ads, as they're called. Mm-hmm. That is the stuff that just is, it is projected onto our websites by contract in instantaneous bidding, actually, digital bidding by bots. And if you sign a contract with a company that is quite irresponsible, you can get really nasty stuff under your label on a website. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right, Ira, that people don't distinguish necessarily between the brand Daily Freeman of what is presented down at the bottom of the programmatic ads and what is real journalism by the reporters there. I don't know the solution to that other than, as you say, news literacy.
And I would imagine that most of the newspapers with which I'm familiar are the smaller or mid-sized newspapers, unlike perhaps the New York Times, which generates all of its content. Everything is done by the New York Times. A lot of these websites, I know Jen's company used to be part of my company, and I don't know what their website looks like now, but I'm sure it used to be like mine in that the content that we didn't produce, we mean the local newspaper, mm-hmm. is produced somewhere else. We have mm-hmm. no control over it. You know, in a print circumstance, if you have an ad on a page for an airline, you know the editors can see that ad is going to be on that page, so they're not going to run the story about the airline crash on that page. We don't have a similar control over what advertising or anything else that we don't produce that is on our websites. And mm-hmm. sometimes it could be misleading or flat out wrong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, before we go, we have just a couple of minutes left. We want to turn to Parkland. We want to turn to what's going on, the continuing coverage from the shooting in Florida. An interesting piece from Indira Lakshmanan, the columnist for the Boston Globe, who also writes for Pointer. And she has made a point that journalists can learn from the Parkland teens. You know, we have all been so impressed, I think, by the eloquence of these survivors of the Parkland shooting. And the power of it came during the CNN town hall, where Marco Rubio was standing there trying to hold on to his A-plus rating with the NRA while at the same time responding to students who were pressing him. There were two things that were remarkable, I think, about this. First, the value of that public meeting on CNN. And second, the power of the teens asking questions very directly and very pointedly. And I think that the notion that Indira Lakshmanan is taking on here is we journalists could learn something about that nature of questioning.
There was a time when I started in the business in sports, there was a time and a theory that we would never interview the high school athletes, that they were immature and it wasn't right for them to be exposed to questioning from journalists. We're talking over 40 years ago. So much of that has changed because of all of the other influence, I think, because of all the other influences in society that are making these kids more mature at an earlier age than they used to be. Mm. And the young fellow, Hoag, H-O-G-G, who's been the predominant spokesman for the Parkland group, is somebody who could go on a network newscast right now, but he's lived through YouTube and all of these other media outlets. They've grown up in an environment that they've matured more quickly.
Absolutely.
And you're right, they can teach us something who are a little bit gray behind the ears.
An education reporter, you can't discount their value of the voice of young people. I mean, they're your constituents. If you look at any local town budget, where's the biggest portion of your budget going to? Schools. Who do schools serve? Students. They very much have a right to speak out. You know, as journalists, you have to use transparency, caution, ethics when you talk to them because they are young people. You can't forget that. But we need to hear from the Emma Gonzalez's of the world and the Hoags of the world. And, you know, we're hosting a forum next month on this very topic, and we have four students participating. We wouldn't have it any other way.
Excellent. Emma Gonzalez, by the way, I understand now has 2 million Twitter followers.
I'm one of them.
Excellent. How about that? Isn't that something? And that speaks to the power of the new media. That's all we have time for today. Isn't that amazing? We've talked about the gender binary of peppers. We've talked about programmatic ads in the White House. There's an awful lot here. Thanks so much to Jen Smith, Ira Fussfeld, Paul Conte. I'm Rex Smith. Thanks for joining us this week on The Media Project.
Got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people.